Daf Torah for the last day of Pesach, and that's in Yishayo Perek Yud, chapter 10. And if you recall, that was a very jubilant prophecy, both about the downfall of Sancheriv, who would be trying to capture Yerushalayim, and he would be defeated at the very gates of Yerushalayim. And ultimately, it was a prophecy about Moshiach. And again, as I say, the Mefarshim constantly vacillate as to whether Yeshayahu is talking about the political events of his time, or is he talking about the long-term ultimate redemption. But the answer seems to be very, very simple, that the political events of his time could have turned into an ultimate redemption. They did not, meaning it turned into a dead end. The Jewish people were redeemed, or not redeemed, but they were saved from Sancheriv, but Mashiach didn't come, Chizkiyahu was not Mashiach, etc. Now, what I want to do, and then we spent a few weeks looking at some other verses dealing with Mashiach and the Christian interpretations and the like. But what I want to do today is I want to actually read. Yeshayahu does not have a lot of history in it, but the truth of the matter is that the prophecy of Yeshayahu Perek Yud actually is described in historical detail in chapters 37 to 40, in which the actual story is told, and I want to go over that story. But first, just a few verses I just wanted to call to your attention. In that Haftorah of Pesach, there are a few verses that the Haftorah concludes with that are very famous verses that are familiar to you, so we should see what they mean in the context. And that is, Well, I'm going to be skipping around today. That's right. You should always bring two volumes if you have the Judaic press, because I go from the first volume to the second volume. But the psukim I want you to look at first are in chapter 12, first pasuk. And this is just the conclusion of that very, very beautiful prophecy. Remember, this is the rod will come from Yishai. This is Moshiach will have the Spirit of God, etc. So, if you look at chapter 12, verse 1, it says, V'yamarta b'yomahu, you will say on that day, that day meaning the day in which the redemption finally comes, Otcha Hashem, I thank you, Hashem, I give gratitude to you, Hashem, ki anafta bi. Now the word anafta, the shorish is anaf, not with an ayin. With an ayin that means a branch. But anaf, aleph, nun, fei, actually means anger, kas. I am grateful to you, God, because you were angry with me. We'll go back to a second. That's what it literally means. I am grateful to you, Hashem, because you were angry with me. Yashuv apcha, but your anger has gone back. You have removed your anger. Usnachaneni, and you have comforted me. So the simple meaning, if you look at, let's say, the Art Scroll translation or other translations, is it means, even though you were angry at me, your anger has been removed from me, and you have now comforted me. Meaning the Pasuk is saying, I am grateful for the comforts that Hashem has brought to us after his anger. But in the Sefer Chassidus in particular, they explain that even the first part of the pasuk is what one is grateful for. I am grateful to you, Hashem, even for your anger. Your anger, your suffering, the persecution, all that we have gone through, we will see in retrospect, is a reason to be grateful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The concept, in other words, is that when we truly understand the course of history, the purpose of existence, we will see that every single obstacle that we faced in our lives was something that made us stronger, something that brought us closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore one is grateful not only for the blessing, so to speak, but one is grateful even for the difficulties and obstacles and impediments, because it is God's way of challenging us and teaching us to go beyond ourselves. And that's what the pasuk says, Beferish HaPasuk. Otcha Hashem, I am grateful to you, Hashem, for even that which you were angry at me. Anger, of course, here means not internal anger, that refers to God doing things, and which seems to indicate his displeasure. You know, they tell the story. The Baal Shem Tov's greatest disciple was the Magid of Meserich, the Meserichur Magid, the preacher of Meserich, right? He was the real success. In fact, he was really the founder of Hasidus in the sense, well, I don't want to, this is not a very nice analogy to use, but in the sense that Paul is the founder of the Catholic Church. I mean, Paul was the great organizer. Right? Jesus taught a few things, but Paul was the guy that made the movement. Well, the Havdol, trillion Havdalos, the Baal Shem Tov, you know, was the inspirational leader of Hasidus, but the Baal Shem Tov died, he had 50 Talmidim. Baal Shem Tov did not create a movement. But the Magid of Meserich actually created the movement. I mean, his Talmidim, he sent all over the place. So one Talmud was the person who became the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. The other Talmud was of Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, because he sent them in different places, and they actually founded all the different movements. So it is said that before the Magid of Meserich died, he promised his Talmidim that when he goes to Shemayim, he will pray to Hashem that he should abolish all of the evil decrees on the Jewish people. And he died, and the evil decrees kept on coming and coming and coming. So his Talmidim were, you know, asking their Rebbe, I don't know how they communicated exactly, you know, why aren't you doing your job? Maybe. So his response, he came back to them in a dream, and his response is, you know, when I died, I really was determined to carry out this mission. But from my vantage point, I just can't find anything bad that's happening. Meaning, at the level of being above it all, everything actually does make sense in a way that we don't understand it. And the Pasuk is telling us when that redemption comes, we will see that even God's anger, so to speak, was ultimately for our benefit. You know, there's a famous thought from the Chiddushei Arim, the first Ger Rebbe, where he talks about the snake. The snake was cursed that it will crawl on its belly and it will eat dirt all the days of its life. So the question is, what is so bad about eating dirt? Dirt is always available. You never have to look for it. So he says that's the whole point. The nachash will never have a need in life. And if it will never have a need, it will never have to have a relationship with Hashem. It will never have to ask Hashem for something. And here you see an amazing thing, that there is a bracha to need things. There is a bracha to feel a lack. Because when we feel a lack, that makes us turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and seek a relationship. If one has everything they need, or if one thinks they have everything they need, then there's not an impetus within the person to seek out a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, the idea of tefillah is exactly the opposite of what we often think. We often think, what is davening for? I have a need, so I pray to fill the need. That's not true. The need is prayer. The only thing is, if I don't have an external need, I'm not going to realize that's what I need. So Hashem creates needs, so we will truly pray. It's the prayer that is the need. The physical thing is just the mechanism to make us aware of that need. And the nafesh that doesn't have that physical impetus is considered to be cut off from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's like somebody that you don't care about, let's say he's been bugging you. Let's say something you have a shulachim that you want to get rid of. I'm not saying it's correct, but you know, let's say you just want to get. So you might tell someone, you know, tell your child or something, just give him some money and get him out of here. So too, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem does not want a relationship with someone. Hashem says to the angels, give that person whatever he wants, just get him out of here. I don't want to hear from him. And that itself is considered to be the greatest curse of all. That is why Chazal say that the imahos, the matriarchs, were barren, right? They didn't have children. And that is so because Hashem desired their tefillos. Hashem wanted their prayers. And this is the idea of seeing that in the apparent displeasure of Hashem is the greatest opportunity to enter into that relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's what we're going to see at the end of time. We will understand this. Otcha Hashem ki anavti bi, I am grateful precisely for the anger, for the failures, for the mistakes, for the sense that I sometimes wasn't in control of things. Because that ultimately gave me the comfort of being able to connect to you. Now the next pasuk, the next two pasukim are undoubtedly very familiar to people who recite Havdalah, these prefaces, the Havdalah service every Motzai Shabbos. Hine, it's nice when you see the pasukim in the context in which they appear. Hine, behold, Kael Yeshuasi, God is the God of my Yeshua, my salvation. Eftach, I will have trust in him. V'lo evchad, and I will not be afraid. Ki ozi v'zimras ka. Ozi, he is my strength. V'zimras, and he is my song. You know, the one that I want to sing in praise. Ka, that's God's name. Ka Hashem. Vayihi li li Yeshua, and he will be for me a source of salvation. Now you understand, number one, why this is put, Yeshayahu was not for Sadiq Fatela. This is where it comes from. But why later our custom is. Now again, those psukim, you're not required to say them in Havdalah. For example, you can be Yotze Havdalah with just the blessings. You don't have to say the psukim. And indeed, many Sephardim do not say those psukim, right? It's not, they say other psukim. It's very interesting. I had the merit when I was in Har Nof for one Shabbos. So Rav Avi Yosef, who was the former Sephardic chief rabbi, but he's considered to be still, I guess Sephardim never resigned their position. He still says he's the chief rabbi. By now it's piling up. You have like three or four after him, and each one still says they're Sephardic chief rabbi because they don't believe that you can resign the position. But be it as it may, he's still considered to be the greatest Sephardic gadol, certainly in Eretz Israel, and among the greatest gadolim. So he has a private minyan in his house. It's a big minyan. Probably 100 people come in, and of course it's fascinating. He has a huge library, as you would expect. But I kept on thinking, here's a person like who, he knows most of the thing in the library by heart, and he just has an amazing photographic memory. The Bar Ilan University produced, you can get this, they produced on a CD-ROM hundreds of volumes of Shelos Tshuvos, hundreds of volumes of responses. It's really an amazing thing. CD-ROM is cheaper than buying the hardcover books. And you could search, you can't use it on Shabbos, but you could search, you could type in, if you want, well, what did Tshuvos say about insurance, whatever it is, and you can get printouts of them, etc. So when Bar Ilan first developed their system, they wanted to show how good it was, so they wanted to test it against a manual search. So they submitted an inquiry to their computer, and they submitted an inquiry to Rav Avi Yosef, see what references he would come up with. And they were boasting at the time that they came up with 9, and Rav Avi Yosef only came up with 2 more. So he came up with 11, and the computer came up with 9. So they were saying, see how great our system is, state of the art, We're almost as good as he was. But anyway, but I did notice that at the end he recites Havdalah, and he said a whole bunch of psukim. I was not familiar with the Nusuf, which we're not. Hine Kel Yeshuasi. But at least among Ashkenazim, we say Hine Kel Yeshuasi. And the reason is the following. That for a Jew, leaving Shabbos is a sad time. Right? It's supposed to be a sad time. You're leaving the holiness of Shabbos. And in the week, number one, we're losing that holiness of Shabbos. And number two, it's also scary. Scary in a spiritual sense, because hopefully one achieves a certain spiritual calmness on Shabbos. Now, one can lose that. One can lose that very, very easily. And therefore, at the very beginning of the week, we declare that I put my trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that He will guide me and protect me, and let me hold on to the Kedusha of Shabbos. Eftach, I'll have bitachon. The Chavos HaLevavos, the great Sefer Duties of the Heart, writes that of all of the midos that a person needs in the service of Hashem, the single most valuable is what is called bitachon. What is bitachon? Bitachon literally means trust. But what do we mean by trust? Trust doesn't mean a person, we say gamzu l'tov, everything will be for the good. That doesn't mean everything will turn out the way we want it to turn out. That's naive. We know things do not turn out the way we want them to turn out. There is sickness and there is death and bad things happen. Or things happen that seem bad to us. But the Chazon Ish used to explain that gamzu l'tova does not mean things will turn out the way we'd like them to turn out. But it means everything that turns out is ultimately for the good, even if in the short run it's not what we like. And bitachon is the feeling of serenity and calmness that a person has when they recognize that nothing can happen to them in this world unless it is Hashem's will, and that Hashem loves them and cares about them fundamentally. And therefore, consequently, what happens to us is a result of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's love, even if it is in ways that we cannot possibly understand necessarily in the short term or even intermediate term. Obviously, there are many, many things that have happened in Jewish history for which we do not have a pat explanation. But the one that has the sense of bitachon has the resilience to go through life even in difficulties, because they know that when they have bitachon, there is nothing to fear. And this is what the pasuk says: Eftach, when I have bitachon, below Efchatz, there is nothing that can scare me. I can look the lion in the eye. I can stick my head in the jaws of the lion. Well, I don't mean that literally, because that would be irresponsible. You know, the Gemara does say everything is decreed by God except getting a cold. There is a Gemara that says that. Because it says if a person is careless and irresponsible, so Hashem is not going to protect them necessarily. You can't rely on miracles. You can't cross against a light on Georgia Avenue and say Hashem is going to take care of me. It may happen, but you know, you don't always get a miracle. In fact, the Gemara says that one rabbi invited another rabbi over for Purim, and they got drunk. And the Gemara actually says one rabbi slit the neck of the other one, killed him. So he was kind of upset after Purim that he killed somebody. So he revived the dead. He was mispalel, and the person came back to life. And then when he invited him next year, the rabbi's response was, you know, I'm not sure if God will do a miracle like that 2 years in a row. So he declined. So there is a concept that no one has a right to go to God and say, make a miracle beyond the normal laws of nature. However, that which, assuming a person takes the reasonable precautions that one takes in life, the Boteach, as the Cholos Halevavos says, has to know that nobody can help me unless it's Hashem's will. Nobody can hurt me unless it's Hashem's will. And that creates a tremendous serenity.
Does that mean that we don't hold others responsible? I mean, if a family member is killed by a drunk driver,
yeah.
Does that mean you're not angry at the drunk driver?
Yeah, well, it's a tremendously complicated issue. Because on one hand, we also believe very much in the concept of free will. Free will means that God does not make a human being do a bad thing. We have total free will. Otherwise, you couldn't punish Paro, you couldn't punish Hitler, because all these, right, but the answer is all these people have free will. So the question becomes, one of the most difficult issues in theology, is how do you reconcile the fact that I have the total free will whether to pull the trigger and shoot somebody or not, but then we say, no person can receive the bullets unless it was God's decree. The answer, again, there are different answers to this. The Aruch Chaim actually said that there seems to be a machlokas. The Aruch Chaim actually says that because of the idea of free will, evil can be perpetrated in the world that is not God's direct decree, because I have free will. But the Chovas HaLevavos seems to understand Hashem as engaged in an amazingly complicated chess game in which Hashem looks at all the people who have decided to do evil, and Hashem matches all the people whose time has come for whatever reason, and Hashem will cause the person whose time it is to die to be in the 7-Eleven when the guy comes in at 2 a.m. and wants to rob the store. So what that means is the evildoer is condemned for his evil. He's done a tremendous evil, and this does not at all excuse the evildoer, but the recipients, it was God's will at that moment. Now again, I want to emphasize, this is not blaming the victim. When I say it was God's will, that does not mean the person is being punished necessarily. And there might be millions of reasons why it would be God's will at a given time. A person's time has come, the neshama is only supposed to be in the world for a certain number of years, etc. We're not describing why it was Hashem's will, but it is Hashem's will. And in fact, the Baal HaTanya also writes, you know, Chazal say, one who gets angry is as if, we talked about this last week, but just to go over it very quickly, one who gets angry is as if they are an idol worshiper. What's the connection between anger and idolatry? So the Baal HaTanya says, because anger is the feeling of being affronted because someone has done something to me that, you know, hurts my dignity or whatever it is. But if you believe that it couldn't happen to you unless it was God's will, then who are you angry at? It must be you don't believe it came from Hashem at that moment. If you don't believe it came from Hashem, that's idolatry, because you're removing Hashem from being in charge of the world. So the idea of bitachon is very, very significant in life, because bitachon, in fact, if we have to pick a quality, I mean, we have to have it ourselves before we give it to our children, but if one had to pick a quality that one would want to give to their children. The concept of bitachon, of trust, is a very, very amazing quality, because it gives you all other qualities. Bitachon helps you deal with anger. Bitachon helps you overcome frustration. Bitachon gives you resilience when there's failure. Bitachon gives you courage to face the unknown. Right? Bitachon is like a foundation for many, many qualities. Because imagine, a person could deal with anger and all these other things. A person could deal with not being afraid of the unknown. So it would be a tremendous benefit in life. It's not a very precise balance. All we know is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did create a world, at least since the eating of the fruit of the Eitz Hadas, the tree of knowledge, where bitachon does require that we utilize natural, in fact we'll talk about this in Yishayo further on, that bitachon does require that we utilize natural means to get what we need. So Hashem gives us all a parnasa. Everyone that has a living comes from Hashem, but the parnasa will not come to you unless you do something to earn it. Meaning you can't stay in bed and have a pot of gold come in front of your house every day. It doesn't, usually does not work that way. But even then, you have to understand the hishtadlus, this is called hishtadlus, this is human endeavor, and this is the gezeira, this is the decree that God decreed when he said, v'zeyas apecha tochal lechem, by the sweat of your brow shall you eat bread, meaning you gotta sweat, you gotta do something to earn your bread. That's considered a curse. That's not considered ideal. In the desert, when Hashem was showing us the ideal way of living, the man came down every day. But that's kind of an otherworldly existence. That's not the world that we live in. We're not people who can live off man. We don't get man. So consequently, it's not available to us in that sense. But even then, the Chavos HaLevavos explains that hishtadlus is not in the nature of a direct cause and effect. It's not, since I worked, therefore I have. Rather, everything is mine. The only thing is, God says to us, I'm not going to, I mean, imagine this situation. Imagine if it would be, Hashem says, I will cause the man to come down from heaven every day if you run around the block. So I run around the block, and the man falls from heaven. Now, it's clear that in a strict scientific causal relationship, there is no causal relationship between running around the block and getting the mud. It's simply a condition for Hashem to cause this miracle to occur. Well, the Chavos HaLevavos says that's exactly what Parnassa is. Now, this is amazing. This is not something that may even make a lot of sense to us. But he says, it is not the pshat that since you work, you have the money. That's simply God's price, God's condition for you to get mud. And everything is mud. In fact, everything is mud. Everything is a gift from Shemayim. There is no causal relationship. And of course, we see this, by the way, we see this in what we often call dumb luck, right? I mean, there are people that, you know, just latch onto something and they become phenomenally successful. Other people work very hard. But the point is, because there is no logical relationship, really, it is all considered to be in the nature of man. And that's why the Chavos HaLevavos makes a point, and all the Svarim do, that one should not be over-invested in careerism. Because although Ishtadlus is a price that one must pay for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's blessing, but beyond a certain point there are going to be diminishing returns, meaning you're not necessarily going to get more by more work. And the way it works is, you'll say, that doesn't make sense, because I know usually if I put in more billable hours in a law firm, I'll bring in more money. Chavos HaLevavos says it doesn't work that way, because even if more money comes in, there will be more expenses. In other words, everything is calculated. HaKadosh Baruch Hu determines how much you're going to have. Now, that doesn't mean you can't make more than that decree. You can make more than that decree, but God's going to get it back one way or the other. Meaning, yeah, okay, you'll have more with that decree, you'll get into some car accidents. In other words, there is a cosmic balancing in which you really cannot become richer than it is Hashem's will that you be, even though you could make more money. In other words, you can increase, but there'll be a compensating factor. I've even seen this in my, you know, more modest situations. But sometimes, if I, you know, give less tzedakah because of the press of Meshulachim and the like, I have found consistently that a week that I give less tzedakah, some unanticipated expense comes up. Now, a person's reaction might be, well, Baruch Hashem, I didn't give so much tzedakah because that gives me money for the car repair. Well, the cheshbon is exactly the could be exactly the opposite. I wouldn't have needed the car repair had the money gone for tzedakah. Right? You don't really know how these things work. So there is a chiyuv of ishtadlus, but one should recognize that ultimately it comes from the money. Well, it's hard to say. The Chavos HaLevavos describes, and by the way, I keep on mentioning this because if you want to know a classic discussion about this, it is in the book Duties of the Heart, a very, very famous classic book. And there's a gate that's called the Gate of Bitachon, the Gate of Trust, in which he talks about these issues. He doesn't describe it as minimal. He describes it as reasonable and average for the way most people behave. That's hard to put your finger on. He also says another thing, though, an interesting thing. He says there's a certain catch-22 in Bitachon. And the catch-22 is that the more one truly believes that Hashem is in charge of his life, the less ishtadlus you have to have. The less you believe, the more you have to work. So he actually suggests that at some level of real, real Bitachon, the chiyuv of ishtadlus might almost get reduced to zero. And there were such people in Nevardik. You know, Nevardik was a great yeshiva in Europe, which was kind of extreme in many ways. They had a very extreme views on things. The altar of Nevardik, for example, wanted to train his Talmidim not to be embarrassed when they do mitzvahs. So one of his mechanisms was he would order people to go into stores and ask for things. For example, go into a grocery store and ask for clothes. Go into a clothing store and ask for nails. Because, you know, by being willing to do things that make you look stupid, that developed, he felt, a certain, you know, fearlessness in dealing with things. So in Nevardik, there's still some old Nevardikers around, as they call them, but they're dying out. There's Nevardik Yeshiva, but the newer people are not the same. That they did not believe, I mean, at some point they believed you put your total trust in Hashem, and Hashem will take care of you. I mean, the Rashi of Nevardik came to America once on a fundraising mission. He did not bring any money with him at all. He did not bring any money with him. So he came, and at the airport, he happened to bump into one of his Talmidim. And the Talmud said, oh, can I give you a ride? And he says, yeah, sure, that'd be very nice. And then the discussion came that the person had no money. So the Talmud asked him, how would you have gone anywhere from the airport if I wouldn't have been here? So the Rashiva says, but you are here. Right? Things do work out. What do you want? You're here, right? And there's another Navartika Rosh Hashiva who had this is kind of hard for Rosh Hashiva who has to do fundraising. He had a visceral disgust for money. He would vomit. He would retch when he would have money. So, I mean, the scene is described. He goes into a rich person in France, and the person wants to give him $100,000 or whatever it is for the yeshiva. Tremendous donation. The person starts, you know, he really gets sick. He has to leave the room. So he always had another person on the fundraising with him. You have to take the money. But the idea of money was so repulsive to the person that he would be physically sick if he'd have to have a dollar in his hand. He just didn't want anything to do with this because he wanted everything to come directly from HaKadosh Baruch. So,
It did.
You know, it did. So these are questions, but again, the concept of bitachon as a general matter, how you balance it with ishtadlus is very, very difficult. Certainly you have to have ishtadlus. On the other hand, if one is obsessed with careerism as a way of having economic security, one is really being shortchanged because there is a balance in life. You'll make more and you'll lose more because ultimately you're not necessarily going to be better off than had you put less investment in it. Lefum Tzara Agra is referred. Yeah, I understand that, but that's not really a problem. Lefum Tzara Agra, which means according to the pain is the reward, primarily refers to your struggle and work in serving Hashem and doing mitzvahs. Yeah, oh, yes, that's very different because when it comes to spiritual gain, everything depends on you because that's what it says. How kol bidei shemayim, everything is decreed by heaven, chutz miyiras shemayim, except for your decision to serve God. So when it comes to your avodas Hashem, I mean, there for sure you have to put in a maximum of ishtadlus. That's correct. That's avodas Hashem. That is not referring to economics and the like.
What about satan? How does that come into play with your trust in God? Who's going to take care of you? How is it?
Well, once again, the concept is that, in a way, that's your choice. Meaning to say, if you choose to put your bitachon on Hashem, then he takes care of you, he protects you, elevates you. But again, that does not mean things will come your way. It will turn out the way you want them to be. But rather, bitachon is the willingness to understand that even the negatives are really positives. And again, these are ways that we don't really understand, but in this way you can really see how the Chavos Halevavos is so correct in saying that the Midah of Bitachon is a foundation for virtually all of the good Midahs that a person needs through life. Because it really gives the person the ability to go on and to recognize that from their failures there could be great, great opportunities. Because the failure didn't just happen, but it happened for a reason. Remember in Harold Kushner's book, it's very interesting, and I think his point illustrates, I think, a fallacy that people often have. You know, his famous book, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People, which he wrote in response to a personal tragedy in his own family. He had a little boy that died of a disease. And he criticizes people who are very facile and quick in giving explanations for people's suffering. You know, you're suffering because of. And he gives a mashal. I don't know if this is a true story or not, about a woman who had traveled all over the world to look for antiques. She had a passionate love of collecting antiques, and after 10 years she had collected quite an inventory, and she had rented a store in a strip mall, those outdoor, you know, those malls, and she was planning after the weekend to open up her antique store, which had been the dream of her lifetime. You know. And the night before the opening, Sunday night, there was an electrical fire in the strip mall, and all of the stores were gutted. Nobody was in them, but they were all gutted. All of her inventory literally went up in smoke. And you can imagine that she was heartbroken, that she had spent so many years collecting, and this was her hope, and you know, just everything was destroyed. And her friends tried to comfort her, Rabbi Kushner recounts, by offering various explanations of Gamzu Latova, such as saying, well, you know, maybe Hashem is trying to teach you a lesson not to be so involved in things and spend more time with your children and to appreciate the life that you have with your family, etc., and not always to be traveling. And maybe this is how Hashem teaches you a lesson. And Rabbi Kushner notes the woman was not very comforted with this, and she was upset that she felt that her friends were not really being sympathetic to her when she went through something. It wasn't a death or a sickness, but still, one can imagine the sadness and the frustration about this. So Rabbi Kushner says, therefore, this cannot be the reason, therefore, it's wrong. Now, we, of course, can never give a reason. The truth of the matter is, we cannot give a reason. Unless you're a Navi, unless you are a prophet, no human being can ever say, look at another human being and say, definitively, this is what happened to you. In fact, even the person herself could not conclude, this is why it happened to you. Right? So we have to understand that. However, there are two points that you have to keep in mind. There is a distinction between the question, what should you say, how should you say it, and who should say it, which is one set of questions, and the question of, might it not be true? Meaning to say that we can all agree, I think, that when somebody is suffering a loss, one's first response needs to be empathy and compassion and not give them explanations. Right? Giving them an explanation is criticizing them at a time when they're vulnerable and weak, and people don't need to be kicked, you know, when they're already down, right? People put salt on the wounds, right? So one could say, okay, they shouldn't have said it, maybe they're not the ones to say it, how do they know, etc. All of that is true. But just because all of that is true doesn't mean that what they're saying might not be true either. Meaning to say that it may very well be that these sufferings come into the world to teach us something, to make us reorder our priorities. Because what's the alternative? The alternative is, it's senseless and meaningless. Is that a more comforting thought? Meaning to say, is it a more comforting thought that there's no reason, it's a totally nonsensical thing that happened to me, and every time I walk out, you know, I am at the mercy of meaningless forces of nature that can destroy me in a moment? Or is it a more meaningful supposition that there is a purpose and meaning in it, you see? So what Rabbi Kushner, I think, fell into error in this particular point is the fact that things should not be said by certain people at certain times in a certain tone is not proof that the underlying idea is false. And indeed, the things that happen are an occasion for us to reevaluate and to recognize that ki anaf to be, that the anger that Hashem shows us, so to speak, is ultimately also for our good. And then we have Pasuk Gimel, which is also from Havdalah, right? We say Pasuk Beis and Gimel. U'shaftem mayim b'sason, you will draw water with joy, mi mayanei ha-yeshua, from the springs of salvation. Now, what is this referring to? Well, in a metaphorical sense, water is often the sign of life. Water is the sign of rejuvenation. Water is the sign of rebirth. Even the mikveh, as you know, one of the meanings of the mikveh is recreation. Water is, number one, the source of life. Right? The human body is whatever it is, 90% water, a lot of water. The womb, the baby in the womb is surrounded by water, and the mikveh is a rebirth, a recreation, a rising from the dead. So one can understand, Torah is compared to water, so one can understand how the imagery of redemption is associated with getting water from the springs of salvation. However, Chazal also say that this pasuk, taken out of context, was also recited during the water drawing ceremony on Sukkot, Nisuch HaMayim. Right? Remember that every korban during the year, you poured wine on the Mizbeach. Sukkos, in addition to the wine that was poured on the Mizbeach, they also poured water. And as they would pour water, they would sing this pasuk, you will draw water with joy from the springs of salvation. And as you know, if you remember from Sukkot, from your learning about it, that the joy of the water drawing was considered to be the happiest, most joyous ceremony in the whole Beis HaMikdash. That the greatest rabbis would spend all night for 7 nights during Sukkot, juggling torches and all sorts of acrobatic tricks and everything else. And we were told that the Nisuch HaMayim, the pouring of the water, in other words, they would fill up the water from the spring right outside of Yerushalayim, right? You can go to Shiluach today. I was looking for it. I didn't want to get too far because there were signs, but it was already an Arab village. Siloam is an Arab village, so you know, I walked like a block into it, and I decided to go back. But right outside the Zion Gate, the Dung Gate, Shar HaAshvos, is Siloam, right? And that's the famous spring from which they would draw the water for the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, and then all night they would be singing and dancing, and in the morning they would pour it on the Mizbeach. So we are told that the reason it's called Shoeva, drawing up, is because people drew up not just physical water, but people drew up Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration and prophecy. That this joy brought people to Nevuah. Ruach HaKodesh does not rest on a person unless they are in a state of joy. Yonah is the great reluctant prophet. He didn't want to go to Nineveh and tell them Hashem wants to destroy them, right? Because what was Yonah's cheshbon? Yonah's cheshbon is, God, I know, you know, you'll forgive them and then I'll look bad and etc. Yonah didn't want to go. So it says, why didn't he want to go? Because he didn't want to be a prophet at all. He was never a prophet. But he was so into the simcha of Simchas Beis HaShoeva that he got zapped with prophecies. You got to be careful not to let yourself go too much. Right? You let yourself get ecstatically in the experience, and you become transformed inside. Huh?
Is the spring still there?
Oh, sure, it's still there. Shiluch, sure, may Shiluch. I mean, there are signs even to the Siloam spring, but people used to. I think in Yerushalayim, that's where in the old city, that's where people go to Tashlich on Rosh Hashanah. They go to the gushing spring. It would also be relevant to what Chizkiyahu did. But that's the gushing spring. U'shaftem mayim b'sasa. And it's very interesting. Rav Huttner once explained, what is the great joy of the pouring of the water? Why was that such an occasion of tremendous simcha? So he explains that what is the origin of Nisuch HaMayim? So there's a medrash that says, on the second day of creation, Hashem made a firmament, a division between the upper waters and the lower waters. Right, everything was water, but then he made the sky divides the upper water and the lower water. So it says that the lower water cried to Hashem, why have you separated yourself from us? And Hashem says there is a time when you will be reunited with the upper waters. And that is by pouring you on the altar, which is a korban that goes up to Hashem. The lower water gets reunited with the upper one. So what is that a symbol of? That's a symbol of us. Because our neshamas were with Hashem at some point. And then we become separated. And as we become, as we do aveiros and get further and further estranged, the separation gets ever greater. But Nisa Chamayim reminds us that it's always possible for the lower person to be reunited with HaKadosh Baruch Hu like the water. And therefore, the pouring of the water is a symbol, and that's why it's right after Yom Kippur, a symbol of the capacity of the neshama to get reunited with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In fact, the Baal HaTanya has a striking physical imagery here. It's an amazing imagery. He says, you know, a human soul is described as Hashem breathing into us. Hashem breathed into us the spirit of life. Now the Zohar says, when I breathe into you, right, mouth resuscitation, there is some of my life force, as it were, that's in the person. Right? So that's why we are really in the image of God. There is somehow part of God's existence is within us because he breathed into us. However, once the breath leaves the breather, there's a certain amount of separation. So he says, tshuva actually means you are returning the breath of God that God has exhaled, and God is re-inhaling it. So he says, the closeness one has with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is as if the breath is back in God, whatever that means. I mean, space, I mean, obviously Hashem is not a thing, but it's as if the breath is back in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That is the closeness of what he calls the upper level of tshuva. The lower level of tshuva is eradication of evil. There's a higher level of tshuva in which you are returning your soul back into the godly essence. That is the level of closeness that we have. And that is what prophecy is, Ruach HaKodesh, and everything else. So this does teach us the importance of Simcha in Avodas Hashem. You know, the song, which is a quote from Rav Nachman of Breslov, Mitzvah Gedola Lios B'Simcha. It's a great mitzvah to be in Simcha. So I was once in a kind of a mixed family where some of the members were Hasidim and some were Misnagdim. So they were singing the song, Mitzvah Gedola Lios B'Simcha. But the Litvak, with his customary skepticism, asked me, what is the source of that? Where does it say, where does it say there's a mitzvah to be B'Simcha? You know, is that just something they say, or is there a source for that? But the truth is, there is a source for that. The Pentagon Chairman, there's a pasuk in the Chumash. Besides, in Tehillim it says, Yetzivos Hashem B'Simcha. That's in Tehillim. But in the Torah itself, when the Tochacha talks about all the punishments that will befall the Jewish people, it says, Tachas Asher Lo Avadata Es Hashem Elokecha B'Simcha. It is because you did not serve Hashem with joy. But there are two translations. One translation is, you're being punished because when you didn't serve Hashem, it was with joy. Meaning, you got joy in your Averis. That's one translation. But the Ari translates it differently. That you served Hashem, but you didn't do it with joy. Right? So there are two different translations, but at least one of those translations clearly brings out the idea of Simcha. That without Simcha, Chazal say, there cannot be Ruach HaKodesh. Yeah. That's in Kisava, the Tochacha in the book of Devarim. Okay, so I just wanted to show you those two psukim, which conclude, and then it goes on and says, V'yamartem, Pasuk Dal, V'yamartem b'yom ahu, you will say that day, Hodu Lashem Kiru Bishmo. This is also taken from our davening. Hodu Lashem, you will call out to others. Give thanks to Hashem, call out his name. Hodiu ba'amim alilosav, make known his actions to all of the nations. Haskiru, remember him. Ki niskav shmo, for his name is exalted. Zamru Hashem, sing to Hashem, ki geos asa, he has done wonderful things. Mudazos b'chol aretz, let the whole world know. And the last pasuk is also a nigun that is often sung. Sali Veroni Yosheva Sion, talking to the Jewish people as a woman that is dwelling in Zion. Rejoice, you who dwell in Zion. Ki gadol b'kirbei chadosh yisof, because the Holy One of Israel is great in your midst. Again, a very, very jubilant prophecy. And again, though, what is poignant about this prophecy in historical terms, and again, without getting a sense of the history, it's hard to know this, is that Yeshayahu believed and was communicating that this downfall of Sancheirib on the gates of Yerushalayim will mean the destruction of the enemies of God and the redemption of the Jewish people and the ushering in of the Messianic age, and this would be it. And all of this is referring to that long-term vision, which Yeshayahu thought would be the short-term vision. It did not come to pass. There was a great salvation, but that only bought time, because shortly afterwards the Babylonians destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, and there's Golos, and there's a second Beis HaMikdash, and a second Golos. So what could have turned into an immediate messianic vision is now a long-term hope for the future redemption of the Jewish people. He didn't. He died. But the point is that Yeshayahu died before the destruction. But Yeshayahu lived during the exile of the ten tribes. And Yeshayahu lived when Sancheirib was about to conquer Yerushalayim. And he was defeated. And yes. But then Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king, comes along around the... potentially Mashiach. Chizkiyahu was Yeshayahu's own son-in-law. And therefore Menashe, in other words, Yeshayahu's daughter married Chizkiyahu. And therefore Menashe, who is the evil son of Chizkiyahu, was Yeshayahu's own grandson. And according to rabbinic tradition, Menashe killed Yeshayahu at a very advanced age. Yeshayahu was already an old man, and Menashe was just sick and tired of, you know, his grandfather always criticizing him. He was giving him Musar and everything else, and he just killed him, along with many other people that he killed. And Yeshayahu was over 100. He was a very old man when he was killed. But that's the tradition. Well, what you have is, basically, after Chizkiyahu, you had King Menashe. Menashe became king at the age of 12 and ruled for 55 years, the longest reign. And that was a reign full of idolatry, of Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, all of those big Averos. And then Menashe was replaced by his son Yoshiyahu, who was a righteous king, but he was killed in his prime. And then you had a succession of three more kings, each of whom ruled a very short amount of time. You had Yehoahaz, Yehoyakim, Yehoyachid, and then you had Zedekiyahu. And Zedekiyahu was the last king, and Nebuchadnezzar conquered Eretz Yisrael and killed Zedekiyahu and destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. So there was a little glimmer of hope in Yoshiyahu's reign, but he was killed. Where were they at? Well, clearly in Yirmiyahu's book of Eicha, which he wrote, Yirmiyahu experienced the Churban Beis HaMikdash. He does write that had Yoshiyahu been able to live longer, he would have inspired Jewish people to tshuva, and that could have averted the korban. Yeah, there was a sense Yeshayahu was the last opportunity. Remember, Yeshayahu, of the three what they call major prophets, although not major, the three prophets are the biggest books, Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, and Yechezkel. Remember the sequence. Yeshayahu lived through the exile of the ten tribes and the defeat, Sancheirib's defeat. After Sancheirib had exiled the ten tribes, Sancheirib had also conquered a lot of the southern kingdom. He was going to conquer Yerushalayim, and he was miraculously defeated. That was the pivotal historical event that's described in the book of Yeshayahu. So Yeshayahu experienced the exile of the ten tribes, the Assyrian conquest of much of the southern kingdom, and the miraculous defeat of Sancheirib to Yerushalayim. And then he died. Yirmiyahu was a little later. He actually experienced the destruction of the southern kingdom and the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash. And the third prophet is Yechezkel, who actually had his prophecies in Babylonia. He actually was exiled in Babylonia, and therefore he's the latest. So they all overlap. It's very probable that Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, and Yechezkel all knew each other. But chronologically speaking, Yeshayahu ended first, then Yirmiyahu, and then Yechezkel. But Yechezkel is very unique. Yechezkel's prophecies are all in Chutz La'aretz. He's really the only prophet in Tanakh who the entire book of Yechezkel are prophecies that came to him in Babylonia, not in Eretz Yisrael. All the other Nevi'im had their Nevi'ah in Eretz Yisrael. Yeah. Assyria, not Syria, Ashur. That's right. Now, what eventually happened was Sancheirib's kingdom was eventually conquered by Babylonia. Babylonia, ancient Babel, is modern-day Iraq. In fact, you hear Saddam Hussein often boast that he is the new Nebuchadnezzar. He's very aware of the history of the dictators of that region. Nebuchadnezzar was a very frightening man. I mean, according to Chazal, he had a pet lion that he used to ride. And indeed, when he died and he went to Gehenna, even the Rishayim in Gehenna were afraid of him. It's recorded in the Medrash. They said, oh no, we have to, you know, as bad as hell is, they said, we have to face this guy here too. You know, so they tried to run away even from Gehenna. Yeah. This was a prophet, Zechariah. Now, this is not the prophet Zechariah that has a book in Tanakh. That prophet Zechariah's book in Tanakh was around at the beginning of the Bayis Sheni. He was the last Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi are the last Nevi'im of the Bayis Sheni. This Zechariah was killed during the days of the Bayis Risha. And it is recorded that he was one of the Kohanim that was a prophet, and he was giving the Jewish people a Nevu'ah that they should do tshuva. And he was murdered. I think he was murdered during Menashe's reign as well. I mean, Menashe killed many of the prophets, and according to the tradition, the blood, he was killed right next to the Mizbeach, the altar, and the blood was bubbling. It would not rest. And when Nebuchadnezzar came and destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, the Gemara records that he saw this blood bubbling, and he asked the Kohanim what was it, and they said, well, it's just the blood of animals. So he slaughtered a lot of animals, and that blood didn't do that, and they finally told him. So Nebuchadnezzar played the role of the avenging, you know, angel of God, so to speak, and he started murdering all of the Sanhedrin and all of the leaders, as it were, to appease the blood. And he kept on going, you know, going and going and going. So there was a tremendous destruction because of that. There was a tremendous onesh that they killed the prophets of Hashem. I mean, murder is always a tremendous avera, but this was also killing a prophet and a kohen of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That was the blood of Zechariah, but it's not to be confused with the other Zechariah, right? So Yeshayahu, as it were, really thought, at least at this moment, that the greatness of Chizkiyahu and the miraculous redemption from Sancheirib might avert the Churban and might usher in the Messianic era, but in fact that was not to be the case. So, as I say, as I said many times already, we have to always understand, therefore, Yeshayahu's prophecies have a double focus, meaning at the time he gave the prophecy, he actually envisioned that the messianic prophecies would be fulfilled in his lifetime. They were not, so then they become long-term. So it goes from the short-term to the long-term. Now, as I say, the actual discussion of the historical events of Sancheirib is in Yeshayahu. It's a group of chapters. This is the only sustained historical narrative in the book. From chapter 36, Perek Lamed Vav, through chapter 39. Right? So it's 36, 37, 38, 39. It is four chapters, which talks about a fellow, pretty nasty guy, Sancheirib, the king of Ashur. Remember, Babylon at this time was not yet a world power. There was a king of Babylon, but it was not yet a world conqueror. The dominant world power at the time was Sancheirib. And Sancheriv had already exiled the 10 tribes. And Sancheriv's policy, which was common in the ancient world, was one of transplantation of populations, meaning when he conquered a territory, he would often shift populations from one place to another place to discombobulate you. In other words, you're less prone to make a rebellion if you're not in a familiar land, etc. In fact, it is recorded in the Book of Malachim that when he exiled the 10 tribes, he brought in a non-Jewish population into the land of Israel, the Northern Kingdom. And those non-Jewish populations became known as the Samaritans, or in the language of the Tanakh, they were called Kusim, simply because they came from Kus. Kus was somewhere in Asia Minor, and they were brought into Eretz Israel. And the Gemara often discusses what is the halachic status of the Kusim, because it is recorded in the Book of Kings that the Kusim were very afraid of the wild animals they encountered in Israel, mountain lions and the like, and therefore they converted. And there's a machlokus in the Gemara: are the Kusim halachically Jewish because they converted, or are the Kusim non-Jewish because their conversion was not motivated out of sincerity? Right? There was a discussion. Now, another thing about Kusim you have to know, though, and that is, the Kusim refer to a people that are, you know, more or less extinct. I mean, even the so-called Samaritans are not necessarily descended from the Kusim, and yet you find in the Gemara all sorts of discussions about the Kusim. Like, why are we discussing Kusim? There weren't any Kusim. So the truth of the matter is, Kusim became a familiar whipping boy for medieval censors of the Talmud. In other words, when the Talmud has many different rules about non-Jews, and some of the Christian censors didn't like some of those declarations, so sometimes they would just take it out, and sometimes they would just change a reference to a non-Jew, they would just call it a Kusi, who was kind of an extinct non-Jew. So very often when you read in the Gemara a reference to Kusi, it does not really refer to the ancestral nation of Kus that was more or less extinct, but it refers to non-Jews in general. But nevertheless, there is a discussion about the actual Kusim themselves. So Sancheriv had already conquered the 10 tribes, he had transplanted the populations, and now he makes his, he turns his gaze southward towards the Malchus Yehuda, and he successfully conquers much of Malchus Yehuda, much of Malchus Yehuda that he conquers. So this was not like, you know, a no victory. For Sancheriv achieved many, many victories, even in the southern kingdom. And now he turns his face towards Yerushalayim. And this is in the 14th year of King Chizkiyahu. Now, just a little background about Chizkiyahu. Again, some of this is familiar. Remember, Chizkiyahu was the son of an evil king, Ahaz. Ahaz was a great, great Russia. Ahaz, not Ahab. Ahab is the northern kingdom. Ahaz, Aleph, Chaf, Zion. And yet, Chizkiyahu was a very, very righteous king. In fact, he was so righteous, Yeshayahu really believed that Chizkiyahu could have been the Mashiach. We will see as we go through this, there were various reasons why that did not take place, some of which involved Chizkiyahu's flaws, some of which involved the flaws of the generation. But I just want to read you a Mishnah. It's very interesting. The Mishnah, this is unusual for the Mishnah. The Mishnah normally is a work of halacha, but there's a Mishnah in Pesachim that describes different things that Chizkiyahu did, some of which the sages thought were good things, and some of which the sages thought were not good things. So you get a sense of what some of Chizkiyahu's activities. Just find it here. This is in Pesachim on page 56.1, side 1. Tanu Rabbanan, Shisha Devarim Asa Chizkiyahu HaMelech. Chizkiyahu HaMelech made six major decisions in his reign. Al Shleisha Hodulo, for three of those things the sages said were a good thing. The Al Shlosha Lo Hodulo, and three of those things the sages said were not a good thing. What are the three things that are good? Number one, Girer Atznos Aviv Al Mita Shel Kavalim. He dragged the bones of his father with ropes through the streets. His father was a Russia, and when his father died and Chizkiyahu became king, he actually put the bones or the body of his father and he dragged it through the streets in a display of public denigration. And this was considered to be a good thing to do because he needed to show people as it were, that his father was a Rasha, and these ways should not be emulated, and Klal Yisrael must do tshuva for the averus that were done during Achaz's time. That's the first thing. The second thing that he did, and this is also recorded in Malachim, Kites Nechash Nechoshes Behodulo. He ground up the copper snake. What's the copper snake? This is in the Chumash. If you remember, when the Jewish people in the Midbar were attacked by venomous serpents, by poisonous snakes, so Moshe Rabbeinu made a replica of a copper snake, and when people would look at the copper snake, they would be healed. They would be healed. This is the symbol of the American Medical Association. I assume the doctors don't mean to say they're snakes, so that's not the message. But the concept is that this is a symbol of healing. Now, what that meant, of course, was very problematical, but the Gemara explains that it wasn't so much, they weren't praying to the snake, but by looking upwards, it reminded them to pray to Hashem. But what happened in the course of time was, this copper snake was preserved as a memory of that miracle, and eventually it became worshipped as an idol. So Chizkiyahu took the copper snake that Moshe Rabbeinu had formed, a very holy object. He destroyed it because it had become an object of idolatry. And this was considered to be a proper thing to do. Then it says the third thing, Gonaz Sefer Rathuos. He concealed the book of medicines, Vahodulo, and they also said that was the right thing. So what is the book of medicines? So Rashi explains here, the book of medicines was like an ancient physician's desk reference. It was a work that had all of the known medical cures of the time, how to use them, how to make them, what their side effects are, and informed consent and everything else. And he withdrew this book from circulation. And this was considered to be a proper thing. Now the question is, why is that considered to be a proper thing? So here it's very fascinating. We actually have, the Mishnah says it's a proper thing, but there's a machlokas, there's an argument between Rashi and the Rambam, why it is a proper thing. Rashi, and this really gets us back to an earlier discussion about the balance between bitachon, trust in Hashem, and hishtadlus, and using human effort. Rashi says it was a bad thing because since people had access to medicines, they were not praying to Hashem to heal them. They were putting too much reliance in science and technology and doctors. And therefore, medical knowledge was, this is an amazing statement, medical knowledge was withdrawn from circulation so that people would turn to Hashem. This is what Rashi says. The Rambam does not refer to Rashi. The Rambam probably did not know of Rashi. But the Rambam, as you know, was also a great doctor, and one might expect that the Rambam might not find that interpretation so good. And the Rambam writes, addressing this idea, says, what's wrong with the Sefer Rathuos? And the Rambam writes, anybody that says, don't take medicine because you're supposed to pray to Hashem, is foolish. The Rambam says, a person who says, I will not seek medical attention because HaKadosh Baruch Hu will heal me, is like a person that says, I will not eat because Hashem will feed me. Yes, Hashem feeds you, Hashem gives you the food, but Hashem requires that you make the effort to take it in. Right? The old story about the person caught in the flood, right? You know the story, he's caught in the flood and the water is getting higher and higher, and the airplane comes to save him, and he keeps on turning it down, and the boat comes to save him, and as he's drowning, he wonders, why has Hashem abandoned him? And Hashem says, well, I sent you, you know, 5 airplanes and 3 boats. Who do you think sent you the boat? Of course Hashem heals you. When Hashem heals you, Hashem requires hishtadlus, that you take normal effort. So you know what the Rambam says? This is amazing. The Rambam says, the reason why the Sefer Rathuos was bad was because lay people were using it and they were self-medicating themselves. They were not going to professional physicians. And therefore, this is what the Rambam says. They withdrew Sefer Rathuos from the general population so that people would go to professionals. Because the Rambam says, it's well known that medicines, if they're taken in the wrong doses or not administered properly, can kill someone, etc., right? So it's very interesting that you have this opposite idea. We see, according to Rashi, that an over-reliance on medical science isn't the thing that one should do. One should concentrate on spiritual resources. The Rambam also emphasizing, of course, the primacy of prayer and Hashem as the source of healing, does say there's an obligation. And we actually pass on like the Rambam. There is an obligation, of course, to seek the best medical treatment one can seek. In fact, there's sometimes a question, it's an interesting question. If you have two physicians, now, if one physician is incompetent, even though he's very, very firm and, you know, does everything, you know, no one says you should go to them. But there's an interesting shiloh, though. If you have two surgeons, one is absolutely the best in the world, let's say, but he's an apikoros, he doesn't believe in God. And the other is competent, but is a religious person. Who do you go to as the shaliach, the one that will be the emissary that Hashem will utilize to bring healing? Do you go to the best possible person that you can get? Or do we say, since healing ultimately comes from Hashem, even though I'm obligated to utilize, you know, the normal mechanisms of health, as long as someone is competent and capable of doing the job, so I'm yotzei my ishtadlis, should I not believe that the Hashem will do his shlichus, will carry out his agency through the one that is a greater believer? It's not clear. There are different gedolim have given different opinions on this as questions have been asked. It's not a halacha psuka. There are gedolim who will say you absolutely have, positively have to go to the best possible doctor you can get. There are others that will stress the importance of the doctor being an imam. Others say, well, we don't really care if the doctor's a mommy. The main thing is that the patient be a mommy. In other words, your doctor could be an apikoros. The point is, God is not healing the doctor. God is healing you. So the main idea is that your faith in Hashem has to be very, very strong. But I remember reading a very moving, there's a neurosurgeon in Hopkins, a black neurosurgeon, Benjamin Carson, who's, you know, he separated Siamese twins. He does very, very complicated operations. And he has a very, very interesting story. He grew up in a poor family in Detroit, and he was a member of a gang. And he was on the verge of becoming, like all the members of gang, on drugs and everything else. And he said that he had an explosive temper, and when he was 15 or so, he pulled out a knife, and he stuck it into someone. But the knife broke on someone's belt buckle. It would have entered the abdomen, and he probably might have killed someone. Then he realized that moment what he had become, how anger had taken him over, and he decided at that moment, that was his epiphany, so to speak, that was his moment in which he decided that he had to change, and he became what he became. But he describes, although he's a Christian, so it's not our religion necessarily, but he does describe how before every surgery, you know, he prays, and as he's doing very difficult surgeries, he feels Hashem guiding his hands through the procedure. Someone that is a shaliach, the sense of the doctor being an emissary of Hashem. That, of course, to be an emissary, like in everything else, one has to be as skilled as one is able to be, the knowledge, right? Because Hashem is not going to throw, as it were, his blessing into an empty vessel. One has to be prepared to be mekabel. But ultimately, God gives you that healing. This is what is said. This is a beautiful explanation they give. There's a mission in Kedushin that says, Tov Sheberofim L'Gehenim, which literally means the best doctors will go to hell, go to Gehenna. What does that mean? It means the opposite. Curing is considered to be a mitzvah. So one explanation I saw is a very interesting explanation that says sometimes the best physician, or the one who fancies himself the best physician, might be unwilling to consult with people that he regards as his inferiors. Because, you know, he's the big expert. And if a patient's care is compromised because the physician was not willing to consult with someone else, that physician is accountable for that. So it's very interesting that the failure or willingness to consult. But there's a Hasidic interpretation that says the following. Tov, the gematria of the word Tov, the best. Tes, Vav, Bet. That's what? 17. So Tov means the doctor who believes in only 17 of the 18 blessings of the Shemona Esrei. He davened 17 blessings. But the blessing that says, Rifa'enu Hashem, you will heal us, Hashem, that Hashem is the source of healing. He doesn't believe that. He believes he's the source of healing. That's the Gehenna. So the doctor that does 18 blessings, that's Chai, right? 18 is Chai. That doctor can be a source of life. But the doctor only has Tov, 17, that indeed will not be the Shaliach. But they tell the story, though, about the idea that a doctor has to believe that Refuah comes from Hashem. They tell the story about Revisal Lechorif. Revisal Lechorif was Revisal of the Sharp One. He was that was his nickname, and the story will indicate why he was, one of the reasons why he was given that nickname, that he was once very ill, and the doctor just gave up on him, said, well, he's going to die, he's not going to make it through the night, and the doctor just left. He didn't even stay by the bed. And a miracle happened, and Revisal got much better. And then 3 weeks later, the doctor's walking in the street, and he bumps into Revisal Lechorif, and he gets very shocked, and he blurts out without thinking, I thought you died. So Revisal said, well, I did die. I had a near-death experience, and I really helped you out. He says, how did you help me out? He says, I went up to Shemayim, and I saw a long line of people in front of a gate, and you were in that line. And I asked the angel, what is this a gate to? So the angel said, well, this is the gate to hell, based on the Gemara that says the best of the doctors go to Gehenna. And I saw you in that line, and I told the angel, let this man go, he's no doctor. You know, so he says, I did you a great, I took you out of that particular line. But again, as you say.
So we should hand out
religious questionnaires for a doctor? Well, might be so. But again, the point is this. I mean, we know that the Rambam was a physician. The Ramban was a physician. We know that, I think, Rav Halevi also practiced. I mean, in those days, there weren't medical schools, per se, but they were people who practiced. So we do know that a physician is fulfilling a tremendous mitzvah every time they help a person deal with illness or suffering or pain. And the point is, this reference is not a denigration at all to the mila of medical care. It simply says that there's sometimes an occupational hazard of thinking that, you know, I'm the one that does it, and then it becomes a sinful attitude of arrogance and pride. When it's accompanied with the humility and the cognizance of faith in Hashem, then it becomes the greatest mitzvah that there is, the mitzvah of saving life, alleviating pain, even if all a doctor or a nurse can do is alleviate fear and anxiety. Let's assume there's nothing they can do for somebody, so to speak, in a physical sense. But they can calm them and make them feel better. That is itself is a tremendous mitzvah. So Chas V'Shalom, Chazal are not denigrating that, but they're simply recognizing the occupational hazard. So those are the three things, just to finish the list, those are the three things that Chizkiyahu did that the Chachamim considered to be proper activities. One is he dragged his father's bones across the ground. The second is he chopped up, melted down the copper snake. And the third thing is he hid the Sefer Refuos, the books of medicine. I'm trying to think if I remember. That is not mentioned beferish in Tanakh. That is only known by Masoreh. It does mention that he chopped up the copper snake. But I think dragging his father's bones, I don't remember if that's mentioned or not. Now, what are the three decisions that he made, which are not considered favorable decisions? Shalosh shalo hodulo. One is, kitzeitz dalsos shelhecho v'shigran lemelech Ashur. Now, this is very interesting. This is a detail that is recorded in the book of Malachim. What you have in this story, by the way, is this story appears, the story we're going to be reading, Chizkiyahu and Sancheirin. That story appears in three different places at great length. So apparently it's a very important story. It appears in the book of Kings, it appears in the book of Chronicles, the Riyayamim, and it appears in the book of Yeshayahu. More or less the same, but there are certain details that appear in one that don't appear in the other. One of the details that appears in the book of Malachim that does not appear in the book of Yeshayahu or the Riyayamim is that when Sancheirib initially began his war against Yehuda, Chizkiyahu tried to placate him by offering him tribute, basically bribe. In other words, stay away from me and I'll give you so-and-so. And one of the things he did was, it says in the book of Malachim, is he removed the gold. The Beis HaMikdash were wooden doors, but the doors were overlaid with gold. He stripped the gold off the doors and sent it as a tribute to Sancheirib in order to keep Sancheirib away from his malchus. And that, the Chachamim felt, was not a proper thing to do because that showed, number one, a lack of faith that Hashem would save him, And number two, why are you giving him the gold from the base of Mikdash? Give him your gold. Why are you taking, as it were, Hashem's gold and giving it to Sancheriv? So that was one thing that was considered to be there was disapproval. The second thing is Sasam Me Gichon Ha'elyon below Hodula. Yeah, it's not clear why this is so bad. But one of you should, again, going back to Shiloh. Shiloach is a spring, right, which is the main source of water for Yerushalayim. But Shiloach itself is fed by another spring called Gichon. Gichon is the source, as it were, for Shiloach. And what Sancheirav did, I'm sorry, what Chizkiyahu did was, Sidkiyahu actually closed up the Gichon spring, so that Sancheirav's soldiers would not have access to that water, and then he had built some other canals to get water from alternative sources. So his cheshbon was, he had a reasonable military decision. He actually destroyed a water supply, or at least stopped up a water supply, in order that the Assyrians should not have access to it. The reason why the Chachamim thought that was a bad decision was because when he destroyed the water supply, he was also destroying a source of water for Yerushalayim, and therefore it was felt unbalanced. This was not a proper decision. The third, that is recorded in Dagmar. The third thing that he did that was not considered proper is really a ritual thing, and that is Iber Nisan Benisan Velo Hodulo. The question becomes one of a leap year. That we have this year, for example. Every few years, actually, 7 years out of 19 years, so it's pretty common occurrence, 7 years out of 19 years, we have two Adars. We have another Rishon, and another Shani. Here's a, I don't want to call it a trivial pursuit question, but it's a nice brain teaser. When can you have two children, one child born after another child, but he'll have his bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah first? Okay, answer. Both children are born in a leap year. So one child is born the 20th of Adar Aleph, and the other child is born the 5th of Adar Beis. So the second child was born afterwards. The year of their bar mitzvah is a non-leap year, so it's only one of them. So it turns out the boy that was born the 5th of Adar Beis will have his bar mitzvah the 5th of Adar, and the boy that was born the 20th of Adar Aleph will have his bar mitzvah the 20th of Adar. That's correct. That's correct. If it's over, yeah, right. What twins could have them almost a month apart for their bar mitzvah. That's correct, because when they're born on leap years, but their bar mitzvah year is only a single other, then you simply take whatever date it was and apply it to the single other. Now, conversely, the other way, if I'm born in a regular other and my bar mitzvah year is a leap year, I don't have my bar mitzvah to the second other, because the second other is the other, right? So then I would be actually 13 years and some extra months. Of course, not just one extra month, but all the extra leap years actually make me older anyway. But be it as it may, what is the purpose of the Jewish leap year, which is a whole month, not just a day like February 29th? The reason is essentially because of the Korban Pesach. The Torah requires that the Korban Pesach be brought in the springtime. And that's because spring is the time of rejuvenation, rebirth, and that is the idea of freedom. And the Maral explains that it's not just a physical thing, but rather the physical rejuvenation of the earth corresponds to the spiritual emanations of freedom. So Pesach has to be when those spiritual vibes are in the air. Now the problem is, a lunar year, which is the Jewish calendar, is 354 days. A solar year, upon which the seasons are based, is 365 and a fourth. So we're 11 days and a fraction short every year. So what's going to happen is, every year Pesach is going to get 11 days earlier. So if in year one it's April 15, year two it'll be April 4, year three it'll be in March, already the winter, right? So it'll keep on moving. Just like Ramadan, the Islamic calendar is totally lunar. It is not solar at all. And that's why Ramadan can occur, right, the 30-day fast can occur any time of the year. When it happens in the summer, very, very tough, because not only is the fast very long, but it's also very hot, right, particularly in the Middle East. This year, they lucked out. Ramadan is located in the winter. However, to have a floating Pesach in particular would be a violation of the requirement of Chodesh Ha'aviv, And therefore, every few years, we stick in an extra Adar. So if Pesach is getting too early, that gets pushed back into the spring. And by having it every 3 years or so, approximately, that always ensures that you're always going to have Pesach in the springtime, right? That's the requirement of Chodesh Aviv. Now, in our calendar today, everything has been predetermined. You know exactly, the calendar has been calculated, so we know exactly ahead of time which year will have a leap year. But in the days when every Rosh Chodesh was proclaimed by witnesses who would go to the Sanhedrin in Yerushalayim, every single year a decision had to be made: should we make the next month Nisan, or should we make it an Adar Sheni? In other words, when you made Adar, you didn't know if that was going to be an Adar Rishon or not, because you didn't yet make the decision on the leap year. And sometimes the decision can be very practical. It's amazing about the flexibility. For example, if the roads were in bad condition, because remember, Pesach is coming up, and all the pilgrims are going to come to Eretz Yisrael. If the roads were in bad condition, they might delay Pesach for a month. I mean, imagine this. They could delay Pesach for a month by making Adar Sheni in order to get the roads in better condition.
So did Pesach
come out in later then? Come out in May, that's correct. Well, it would have to be within the spring season, but as long as you weren't into the fall. So it's almost like women might sign a big petition to the Sanhedrin, you know, let's have a leap year because we, you know. I mean, there were reasons. You couldn't do it for any reason at all, but there were reasons other than the issue of Pesach being too early. For example, if the reproduction cycle of the sheep and the sheep, which are the Korban Pesach, if it was late, so the sheep were too young, there weren't enough sheep to bring as a Korban Pesach, that would be a reason for delaying it a month. Right? Reasons like that. So the question becomes, how late can the decision be made? How late in a year can the Sanhedrin decide to make Adar Sheni? And the short answer is, they have to make the decision before the month of Nisan starts. Meaning to say, we have Adar. If we've already proclaimed this month as Nisan, it's not yet Pesach yet, we can't say, let's revise that, let's call it Adar Sheni, and we'll have Pesach next month. Meaning, once the month has been proclaimed Nisan, right, you cannot go back and revise it and call it Adar Sheni. But when you're still in Adar Rishon, or Adar, you're still in the month of Adar, right? And you didn't know it was Adar Rishon, just proclaimed it Adar, you can say in Adar, you know, we're going to make this Rishon and make the next month Adar Sheni. Well, that's right, it could mess up dates, absolutely. In fact, there's a whole problem, because if people celebrate Purim, this would be a situation where between Purim and Pesach could be 2 months, because normally Purim is supposed to be celebrated Adar Sheni. But if they celebrated Purim and Adar Rishon because they didn't know there was an Adar Sheni, then they would actually have to celebrate. Well, it's not clear in a case like that. Would they celebrate another Purim?
Yeah,
no, Purim is always Adar Sheni because
know,
you want to connect the redemption. It's Machlokes in the Gemara, actually. I mean, it's not so clear. The Gemara discusses different opinions, but we rule that we want to connect the miracle of Purim with the miracle of Pesach, so you want to connect it. However, in a case where you didn't even make the decision to have a second Adar till after Purim, in that case, you already kept Purim because you didn't know there would be a second Adar. But be it as it may, going back to this, so one of the things Chizkiyoh did was, Chizkiyoh, for various emergency reasons, actually wanted to make a leap year after the month of Nisan already started. And that the Chachamim said you're not allowed to do. So those are three things that Chizkiyoh did that the Chachamim said were not proper. Well, the Gemara explains that he really didn't want to do it when Nisan began in earnest, but it was like the 30th day of the month of Adar. So it was the last day of the month, and he thought he was still in Adar, and that already was already considered the month of Nisan. Yeah. Well, it doesn't say that he did it. He just urged it on the Sanhedrin, and they did not accept his proposal. I mean, as a melech, he could certainly submit a request to the Sanhedrin, and they did not accept it.
Yeah.
The three things that were negative was he closed up the water supply. He cut down the gold from the doors of the Beis Hamikdash, And the third thing is he tried to manipulate the Jewish calendar at the once it was Nisan to make it Adar Sheni. Because you understand what the problem is. The problem basically is, because if people already think the month is Nisan, and they're going to be observing Pesach at that point, and then the month gets changed to be Adar Sheni, then they're going to think they're in the month of Iyar, when in fact they're in the month of Nisan, and they're going to be eating chametz during what is Pesach, because they think it's a month after Pesach, right? So it's going to be, there's a lot of confusion. You can't rename months. Once a month has been declared to be a certain month, you can't go back after the fact and just rename it and change the time. Now again, today we don't have this issue at all. Everything is predetermined in terms of 7 years out of the 19-year cycle. What was time the other? Okay. All right. So we'll stop here. But so for next week, what we will look at is we will look at this unit of Prakim, Perek again, Perek Lamed Vav. Maybe we'll finish it as a unit. Lamed Vav, Lamed Zion, Lamed Ches, and Lamed Tes. Those are four chapters dealing with the narration of Hizkiyahu's encounter with Sancheirith, and also the discussion of his illness. There were two things that happened. Basically, it happened at the same time, and they are related. He had a deathly illness, as well as facing the enemy of Sancheirith, and how he was redeemed from both. Okay, so we'll see you next week.